Hi folks, you know what this is. This is me asking you to support the Tortoise Shack. This is me asking you to help keep an independent platform, independent, ad-free, and editorially no interference. Why that matters, it means we can have those conversations. We don't have to worry about fake balance. We don't have to concern ourselves about, are we offending sponsors, or are we getting ourselves into trouble with a editorial oversight that is worried about political persuasions or maybe putting people off. But because we do that, it makes it very difficult to make this work. It requires some of you listening to go to patreon.com/tortoiseshack to chip in. It's a fancy cup of coffee once a month, and it really makes all the difference. And for that, there's lots of other benefits. Last night, we recorded a great conversation with children's rights solicitor Gareth Noble on the autism centres. Today, we have John Schwartz of The Intercept coming back about what's going on in the US. And tomorrow, we have former UN Special Rapporteur for Housing, Leilani Farah, and that's just in like 36 hours. All of those go up straight away on the Patreon feed, and you don't have to listen to me plea for your support, but I really do plea, because we do need to. Not proud, we will beg, we will ask, because we believe in the work, and I think because thousands of you are listening, lots of you seem to get something out of it. So if you get something out of it, please give something back. One more time, patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Thank you so much and enjoy the podcast. Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves, and we are back talking to our friend, journalist Hannah McCarthy, who now is back in Beirut, which is like your second home, Hannah. How are you?
I'm good, Tony, and thanks. Yeah, it's nice to be back in Beirut for a couple of weeks.
Yeah, last time we spoke, you were in Ukraine. Then the time before that, you were in Afghanistan. But Beirut has been kind of where you've kind of set out to see the world and cover many of the things that don't get enough coverage. And if you are listening to this, follow Hannah's work on Twitter. The link is in the post. Have a look at the report she's done. She's done lots for RTE as well on World Reports, and it's great stuff. I particularly was taken by the stuff that Hannah covered on Afghanistan and the battle for what is really starvation. Let's be honest, it's food insecurity. But nonetheless, you happen to be there, Hannah, again, at interesting times, because there's just been an election, and the election corresponded with the 74th Nakba of the Palestinian displacement of 800,000 people. And a lot of Palestinian refugees remain to this day in Lebanon in different camps that were well known. Can you just, first of all, before we get into the election results, listeners might not be aware that it's not a normal, I use that word normal in a loose sense, but it's not the sort of parliament setup that we would expect or we're used to. So just give us an idea of how it's shaped and why it's shaped like that.
Sure. So the system, it's a bit like Northern Ireland system, if you had, you know, eight different parties. So instead of just, you know, the unionists and the nationalists, you have eight different groups that expect to have, you know, their share of seats. So there's broadly three big groups, Sunni Muslims, Shia Muslims, and Christians. But within that group, there's different factions, there's different alliances. And the electoral system, at least for the parliament, is set up so that each of these eight religious groupings has their own share of the seats, with the majority going to Christians, then to Sunnis, then to Shias, and then to the smaller groups. And this is kind of designed, you know, based on a census kind of back in the 1930s, and then kind of updated during the peace agreement that ended the civil war, and then updated again following the almost civil war kind of with Hezbollah. Over the kind of different years since then. So it's a kind of complicated system. You know, we know from Northern Ireland that when you have these kind of religious divides, it makes it very hard for new candidates to come in. You know, there's family, there's clan voting, there's religious voting. You know, people want to vote for the person that they see as most likely to protect them, which kind of often remains the person who is the same religion as them. And then to complicate this, you know, in recent years, it's not even just a kind of religious divide. You've also seen alliances between, you know, Hezbollah and the Christian Free Patriotic Movement, who currently has the president. So again, it's not purely religion. There's also alliances that are backed then by other countries within the Middle East. So for example, Hezbollah is backed by Iran, as is Free Patriotic Movement. The Sunni party led by Saad Hariri Future Movement was backed by Saudis as well. And then actually, I'll talk about it a bit more, but again, you're seeing a kind of geopolitical background to these elections as well play out with kind of Iran losing and Saudi Arabia technically winning in this election.
Yeah, I think you've just, I mean, I was nervous how we described this to listeners. I think you've done a really great summary in 3 minutes. There's the religious divide. There's the cultural divide, and then there's the proxy war that's playing out in the global geopolitics as well. And it's just such a labyrinthine thing to look at from the outset. But there has been we've seen this phrase being derided in the recent Northern Stormont elections about seismic changes, and everyone said, oh, it's not really seismic, and people arguing over the differences and the rise of Alliance Sinn Féin First Minister and the fall of the DUP. But there's been some breakthroughs and some changes in these results, and they weren't expected, because, as you point out, it's hard to break through in a system that's set up to not really allow people to break through.
Sure. Well, I mean, just for background, the last election was in 2018. So since then, Lebanon's had the port blast, they've had the Thawra, the kind of anti-government protest movement, and they've had the worst economic crisis in the world. So in any other functioning democracy, this election would be, a change election. There is no way if, Dublin Porsche exploded due to Fianna Fáil's negligence and, 70% of Irish people went into poverty in the last like 4 years, that Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael would still be in power. They would all be out without a doubt. So, I mean, when we're talking about a change election in Lebanon, it's always going to be a small, it's going to be on a smaller scale because that's what the system.
But I recall we spoke after the port blast, and we spoke to Seamus Malakazali as well, who had studied in Lebanon and lived there for years. And one of the things you pointed out back then is that the other organization no one really wanted to take over either, because the economy was so bad that, people don't understand when we say the economy is the worst in the world. The IMF had said it was gone beyond the fact of falling, it had crashed. And because reports were saying, oh, Lebanon at danger of crash point. And the IMF were saying, no, we told you it crashed 6 months ago, pre-explosion in the port. And now it's actually gotten worse. Has the economy continued to bounce along the bottom, Hannah?
So, I mean, in terms of the management of the economy and how the Lebanese economy works, like, there is no government basically, and even civil servants are appointed by WASTA, depending on what community they're from. Most of them turn up for 2 days. In terms of anyone actually managing the economy, that's kind of non-existent. But what you do have is kind of decentralized villages that do the best they can. So I think there's always this debate of how much worse it can get, in the sense like the Lebanese economy is set up on the basis that no one's coming to help you. So, villages have their own kind of small ecosystems, which is also why, lots of these kind of civil war era parties are still in power. They come around, they'll help out, with costs here and there, they'll pay for schooling, for education. And I mean, one of my friends kind of described it, to his dad, who was considering kind of voting again for one of these parties, was, it's like they hand you $50 and steal your kind of wallet at the same time. And again, even though, the government, it's like, Lebanon is bankrupt, the actual politicians aren't. Like Nejat Mikati, the current kind of prime minister, he's the richest man in Lebanon. So, I mean, there's always a way to skim off the top if you want. And the kind of influence they have, they absolutely monetize it. So, I mean, while obviously there's no money in Lebanon, I mean, most of these people have their
and there's no international supports coming. There's foreign remissions from people sending money from abroad, but it's not like the international banks are queuing up to, put sort of structural packages in place, because they've made the demands of, we want to see this reform and that reform. And it seems to have just gotten stuck in a washing machine cycle of round and round we go.
Yeah. Well, the problem, though, is that because Lebanon has such a big population of Syrian refugees, that the EU does not want, all crossing the Mediterranean coming to the EU, that there is still huge foreign aid flowing into Lebanon. And what we saw last year was that they required all UN funding to go through local banks, and they kind of gave, you know, a very bad exchange rate in order to skim. I think Reuters reported it was something about 200 million they skimmed off foreign aid that was supposed to go to Syrian refugees. So again, they'll work out where there's kind of funds coming in and they'll find a way.
Yeah, but could I come, just be put the, I also heard that referred to as the first gate on Fortress Europe is in Lebanon. And, you know, Europe can't pretend that that's not happening at our behest, because we are effectively outsourcing that responsibility to Lebanon. So, you know, there has to be some sort of internationally, especially within the EU, acknowledgement of if this is happening, that it's happening with the funds that we're using to make sure that refugees are turned back. Maybe you think I'm being unfair, but I do think there's an EU angle that needs to be addressed on this.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it's complicated in the sense, like, Lebanon has taken huge amounts of refugees. It got the biggest refugee per capita population in the world. That said, the rights that refugees have in Lebanon are incredibly poor. So on one hand, they obviously have pressure on their own resources, but I think a lot of the evidence has shown that Lebanon has actually not lost out because of the refugee population, in the sense that the huge amount of development aid that has flown in has offset that. And again, the crisis, I mean, ever so often local politicians will try and say, oh, the economic crisis is caused by the refugee crisis. It's not caused by the refugee crisis. It has been exacerbated by the Syrian civil war, which cut off a lot of the export and trade.
What was the last time Lebanon had taken over 1.5 million Syrian refugees? I think it was something.
The figure kind of varies a lot. And actually, the Lebanese government asked the UN a couple of years ago to stop counting people. So it's kind of a shifting number, but it's up to 1.5 million.
So, I mean, but at 1.5 million, this is a huge, just like Lebanon is a small country and densely populated in certain areas. And as you said, running on these towns. If we can turn back to the election, though, I think, first of all, how are we now Tuesday morning and we still don't really have the results, Anna? Is this, you know, there seems to be a slow drawn out process of making the lads counting in the count centre at Ashburn look like speed demons.
Yeah, sure. So just for background, there was a kind of elections and voting held in Lebanon. There was also a diaspora vote where Lebanese went to their embassies wherever they were around the world. So there was obviously some logistics involved in bringing those votes back to the local constituency where they had to be voted, to be counted in Lebanon. So that's also part of the delay, is that you had kind of bags of votes coming in from abroad. So it's been a slow process, and, you know, a lot of the votes that people would have heard about yesterday were preliminary votes, but we're now kind of at a point where we've got kind of the final vote. Overall voter turnout within Lebanon was down. You know, this is due to kind of people just not having enough money to kind of go home, to people, particularly Sunnis, not having someone to vote for because Saad Hariri's Future Movement kind of sat out this election, and also just general apathy. But actually, there was a huge uptake in the diaspora voting, a three-time increase on the last elections. Obviously, immigration has been huge since then, but also, you know, you'd expect a kind of more liberal changed mindset among the diaspora.
Wasn't there a brain drain, in effect, where people who could leave did leave? And, you know, you lost doctors, professionals, medics, and you know, that kind of management class, in a way that if they had the ability to go, they left. So it makes sense if they're sending back votes. They're less partisan, they're less, maybe I'm going to use that term that we use in the North, sectarian, you know, and they can vote with that. So you think that's had an impact?
Yeah, it has. And I think because domestic turnout was lower, and diaspora voting was higher, you know, that's definitely going to benefit independent candidates. And, you know, a lot of the independent candidates are kind of, you know, centrist, maybe kind of center-right kind of leaning. It's not that you have this big kind of socialist or left-wing movement, but there was one kind of left-wing candidate that did almost get elected. And, you know, he's not a candidate that really would normally ever have a chance in a Lebanese election. And I think he lost by 88 votes in the end. So again, it's kind of small changes, but you know, there's definitely candidates that were much more competitive than in any other kind of election before.
That's I think that's really interesting to show. Like again, you know, when we talk about the diaspora having a vote in the Irish presidential election, I know it's a completely different thing, but it just shows that the impact it has. And I remember talking about that brain drain that had occurred. Like there are, I think, upmost of 10 independents seem to have done well, and some of the how do I put this? Some of the Hezbollah seats that were looked upon in the equivalent of if you're talking the British elections where they said the red wall would never fall. We've seen some of the Hezbollah seats that they've had for nearly 40 years have fallen. Are they really feeling that this has gone against them? As you said, is that in the proxy war that it's Saudi Arabia has trumped Iran in this?
I mean, Hezbollah supporters, you know, it's kind of similar maybe to kind of like Sinn Féin in Northern Ireland, in the sense, like, obviously there's some people who are driven by the politics of it, but they're also, you know, looking after a group of very poor voters in Lebanon, who really were kind of fueled by, you know, economic reasons and, you know, dire conditions they're facing in their day to day life. And they've just not seen any improvement. So there obviously is, you know, political and religious backing to it. But there's also people who genuinely were fueled by, you know, a desire to have, you know, better living conditions, electricity, more affordable food. And Hezbollah has just not delivered on that in a way that many would have been hoping. So, you know, some of those voters, it's definitely not a case that they're making a decision about, you know, Iran or Saudi Arabia. Some of that in the south, that, you know, where UNIFIL is, you know, those villages are very poor. And you know, people just have not seen any improvement in the last few years.
Yeah, I think it's I know, when we talk about poverty, it's relative in terms, like, we're talking, you know, electricity shortages, to the point where, you know, people are going to reporting to hospitals with food poisoning because they can't keep food cold, or they can't preserve it as they are, you know. But it is also, we can compare it to political trends everywhere where people feel social mobility has ended. We're not getting better off. My kids are worse off than I was, and they are voting like that. So yeah, no, it is the same sort of pattern. If I could ask you to sort of give me your opinion on, will it be easy for them to form a government at the end of this process? Or are we looking at another long drawn out, you know, passing of the ministerial roles and the heads of state roles?
I mean, no government or kind of major political appointment has been quick over the last kind of few years. I mean, the quickest has usually been the Speaker of the House, which actually this time around looks like it might be less quick to be kind of a done deal. It's Nabi Berri, who's been there since the Civil War. But, you know, the votes that he'll need are kind of less certain than last time. No one has a majority. Hezbollah and its kind of alliance with the Free Patriotic Movement, which is a Christian party, and some other groups, is gone. They and the Free Patriotic Movement now have 62 votes, which is about three short of a majority. It's a pretty fractured parliament. And then what some people kind of say is, this is what, you know, Saudi Arabia wanted, or this is what Iran wanted. They wanted, you know, a divided, destabilized parliament. That's one way of looking at it. At the same time, you know, there are, you know, 13, I think, on the last count, independent or opposition candidates. That's not including kind of a group of other candidates who kind of were MPs who will be kind of, you know, likely to vote with them at some point. So, you know, it's the start of, you know, an actual opposition in government. That said, again, you know, I think when I arrived in September 2020, it was a year before there was a new government formed. So there's all to play for, I think, over the next couple of months.
Yeah. Hannah, look, I think we'll leave it there. Are you planning any more trips this year, or are you going to try and take a few time out away from the airplanes?
Well, I'm waiting on a visa for Pakistan, which they seem reluctant to give to me at the moment. But hopefully if that comes through, I'll be there shortly.
Well, look, you know, give me something else to worry about. If I see you posting pictures from somewhere else where I say, oh, my God, where is she now? What is she at now? For listeners' benefit, when Hannah arrived in Kharkiv, we were told Kharkiv was the safe place. And I think it was within 8 hours later, a missile started falling 8 miles away from you in that situation. So, yeah. Please be safe. I've got one final question. I don't know. Has the Palestinian issue come up again? Because you sent a very interesting tweet where you said during the elections, Palestinians are confined to their areas, I should say, their camps, and they're under curfew. But what is the situation there?
So just for kind of a listener's benefits, like Palestinians who might be the third or fourth generation born in Lebanon have no voting rights. They're not allowed to own property. They're not allowed to become lawyers, doctors, any of the kind of major professions. And Palestinians who are living in the camps are under pretty draconian security measures. Palestinian camps are kind of, you know, considered security issues. Fighters have kind of been located there before, but again, it's not actually necessarily related to the Palestinian community. And what you've seen is a really heavy-handed approach to them. You know, people have said the checkpoints, you know, in and out of camps in Lebanon are kind of similar to what you would see from Israeli checkpoints. So during the elections, Palestinian refugees and Syrian refugees in some parts of the country were put under a 24-hour curfew, so they weren't allowed out during the election day. This is also partly, I think, for the Palestinians because it was Nakba Day. So they're basically not allowed to protest. You know, the Lebanese forces don't want any disturbances. Particularly, I mean, last year there was kind of rockets fired from Palestinian camps during the Gaza war. So what you see is an incredibly heavy-handed response to that. That basically means that, you know, Palestinians don't have kind of normal kind of, you know, access to travel and, you know, free movement.
Yeah, I'm glad I asked that question because it outlines it so well. Because I spoke to Ines Haman from We Are Not Numbers, the organization that works with young aspiring journalists and students in Gaza to try and help tell their stories. And, you know, again, We Are Not Numbers, are kind of, you get the idea of what it means. It's not just, you know, clashes happened and 13 people were shot or whatever. It's about telling personal stories of who these people were. And she said about her father being 5 when the Nakba happened. And, you know, beside her names, it will say refugee. Beside her name, it says refugee. And then it will continue to say refugee. So they're very much not afforded the same rights in Lebanon as they are, as they would be. But they don't have a homeland to return to because many of them have carry front door keys to homes that no longer exist. It's a whole other story for another day. But Hannah McCarthy in Beirut, thank you so much again for talking to me. I really appreciate it. Do follow her. She has put up some wonderful stuff. And if you actually just want to see something a little bit magical, go find Hannah's coverage of the traditional Afghan dress it's really, really start. Like, I mean, because the image we have of Afghanistan, obviously from media, has been, you know, quite dark and dull and beige and brown and black. But Hannah, you can testify the Afghani designers are make incredible dresses and like it's just stunning stuff. I'd recommend check out. That should be all still on your Instagram and on your Twitter feed, isn't it?
Yeah, it's all on my Instagram.
Yeah, I definitely check it out, folks. It'll give you a little bit of a lift and a show into what those bright lights and colors and culture can look like. Thanks for listening. Back this evening with a Ukrainian government MP, Maria Mezentseva, who was on a diplomatic mission to Vienna. So we'll get the latest from the Ukrainian government then. Thanks for listening. Talk to you all soon. Take care. Bye-bye.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony, speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber Podcast. Subscribe now on Patreon.